Hey, it's Kristen. You're listening to Rational in Portland.
Welcome to Rational in Portland. I'm your host, Kristen. I have Harrison Cass today in the studio. He's running for Portland City Council in District 3. Harrison, welcome. Thanks for coming on the show.
Yeah, thanks for having me. Appreciate it.
So currently your day job when you're not campaigning is you're a policy advisor for Commissioner Gonzalez here in the city of Portland.
That's right.
And we were just talking off air and you were saying that you came to Oregon from the East Coast.
Well, I grew up on the East Coast. I bounced around a little bit in my 20s. I was pretty transient. Not transient, just dislocated. Yeah, looking for something, found it in Portland. But I did grow up on the East Coast, born in Manhattan and raised in Connecticut, in Newtown.
How did you decide to stay in Portland?
I loved it. Yeah, it was felt like home. I loved the geography, loved the quirky culture. Yeah, it just felt right. And I have a dozen or so reference points. And many of the, I've been through that liberal circuit of sister cities like Denver and Austin, Southern California, Northern California.
The liberal circuit, yes.
Yeah. Yeah, Portland just felt right and loved it.
And so how did you end up doing policy work at City Hall?
I'd always been interested in politics and policy. I went to law school to get into politics and policy.
Where'd you go to law school?
At University of Oregon in Eugene.
Okay.
Yeah, and spent my third year in Portland. Yeah, so proud to be a duck.
How did you do your third year in Portland?
They have an extension program.
I didn't know that.
Yeah, so half the grade in the University of Oregon migrates up to Portland for the third year, myself included.
And then for the extension program, are you doing some kind of like internship or externship or something?
Exactly. Yeah, that's most, it's not required, but most people do. That's the reason most people do it. I spent that time at the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers.
Wow. Mm-hmm. Here in Portland.
Here in Portland.
Okay. And you're a pilot too.
I'm a private pilot. I'd expected to have a career as an Air Force pilot. I was selected and sworn in, but medically discharged. But I am still a pilot. I'm a little bit rusty, but love aviation.
Do you ever think about just being a commercial pilot as a career?
It has crossed my mind. It crosses my mind. I have a friend who is a pilot for United. He loves it. I didn't pursue that. I was a little bit bitter after the Air Force discharged me. I was kind of in that fighter pilot or bust mentality.
Yeah, it sounds like it was some kind of medical discharge, but you thought it was, when we were talking off air, you said you thought it was maybe they were exaggerating the extent of the, whatever they decided the medical issue was.
Well, the Air Force has a reputation for being a little bit neurotic about medical standards than the other branches or commercial aviation. My understanding, based on my discussions with the flight surgeon, is that I probably could have flown for a different branch. Like color vision, for example, I passed the color vision standards of the other branches. I passed the military entrance exam at MEPS for color vision, but the Air Force has a different standard, the hardest standard there is. So I didn't even know there was an issue until I got through the door and they tested me on what's called the cone contrast test, and I failed that. And that's disqualifying. They also... they dinged me with what was called inferior corneal topography. They thought over time my corneas would thin and steepen and exacerbate astigmatism. And, that never happened. They thought it might happen. It never happened. I'm fine. And so that's what I mean. They're very neurotic. They also found a heart condition I didn't know I had. That wasn't disqualifying, but technically I do have AV blockage in the first degree. But yeah, their main problem was with the eyes. And again, that probably wouldn't have been disqualifying with another branch. So that was extremely frustrating. I invested about 3 years in that process. And, that was a setback. That one hurt. But
so after you graduate from law school and you've done this stint in the Army Corps of Engineers, what happens? What do you do?
Pandemic. Went to get a master's in international relations and global journalism from NYU. And that was a wonderful curriculum.
Did you move over there?
Portland was still the home base, but went over there for, we rented there for the semesters. Wow. My wife was in an MBA program at the time. And so we were going to school out there, riding out that pandemic, that peak of the pandemic there, mm-hmm. when we were in quarantine. Mm-hmm. Yeah, graduated and have been working at City Hall ever since.
And you did you get a job with Commissioner Gonzalez? That was your first job at City Hall, or you worked for somebody else?
I started on a fellowship, a public safety fellowship with Mayor Wheeler. Yeah. And then I had a good experience there, but I defected. I felt a little bit more closely aligned with Gonzalez.
What's a public safety fellowship?
Well, it's a Hatfield Fellowship. PSU sponsors what's called a Hatfield Fellowship. I came in to work with the public safety team with Mayor Wheeler. So they designated it as a public safety fellowship, but formally like PSU, it's just a Hatfield Fellowship. So,
and anybody can apply for this?
It's, what was it? It was available for graduate students. Or, okay. Yeah, recent graduates of graduate programs. So a lot of PhDs.
And masters. So you guys knew that you were coming back to Portland.
Yeah, we.
And that seemed like a good entree back in.
Yes, exactly. I wanted to get my foot in the door at City Hall. Yeah, and that was a perfect entrance point. So, yeah, I'm fortunate for that opportunity.
Why not? Why did you decide to do grad school, not practice law?
I never wanted to practice law. Yeah, I thought maybe I would as a transition.
Why go to law school?
I wanted the education. I have no regrets about going to law school. I thought it was there's no equivalent to the quality of that education, the way it forces you to think and the way it clarifies your thinking and your writing abilities. I always wanted that. My brother had been to law school before me. I trust him very much. He vouched for the curriculum and the effects, and he practiced law for a little bit and transitioned out of it. So I saw that as a...
What does he do now?
Well, right now he works for a think tank, a foreign policy think tank in DC. They are restraint-based.
What does that mean?
It's a realm of thinking within the, with respect to international relations. So they advocate for more restrained U.S. foreign policy, as opposed to kind of like our current foreign policy is a little bit more interventionist, a little bit more involved abroad.
So this is more isolationist?
No, I wouldn't call it isolationist. That's kind of used almost as a slur lately. It's kind of like a derogatory way of looking at it. They're not necessarily advocating for isolationism or a detachment from foreign affairs, but just less involved, like physically less, maybe we don't need to invade Iraq and Afghanistan simultaneously, more of that perspective. Maybe we don't need to give Ukraine and Israel a blank check, coming from it from that perspective.
Mm-hmm. And so how did you, when you say you align more with Commissioner Gonzalez than Mayor Wheeler, what specific policy points would you identify?
Gonzalez was more obviously and more willing to articulate like a harder stance on public safety issues. And that's not a knock against Mayor Wheeler. I have a lot of respect for that administration and the people in that administration. Commissioner Gonzalez was really speaking my language with respect to the problems in Portland.
In what way in particular?
He was very supportive of first responders. He advocated for increasing the ranks of first responders, police, fire, 911 call takers. He was critical of the Police Accountability Commission's proposed oversight. If you're familiar with that, 90s.
Yeah,
he was very critical of that in a way that closely mirrored my thinking. Early in his tenure, he pressed the county to stop distributing tents and tarts, which, again, mirrored my perspective on that issue. So across the spectrum, he was seemed very closely aligned with me. So we had some discussions and found that we were in alignment and got along. And I was happy to move over there.
What do you say to people who argue that stopping the distribution of tents and tarps makes things more dangerous for street homeless people?
I think we need to stop giving people the tools to just barely get by on the street. I think we need to...
Or not get by, right? Because we know these tents and tarps provide some sort of cover for overdoses and fires start. And people are dying in these things.
People are dying.
And being burned alive.
Absolutely. Yeah. The problems related to the tent encampments are extensive. So yeah, like you said, it's lots of overdoses, lots of violence. I don't think people appreciate
violence too. Sexual violence, sex trafficking.
Exactly. I think something like 41% of our fires start in those camps. Obviously there's sanitation issues related to those camps. traffic issues related to those camps. So, something like half of our pedestrian deaths last year are people, you know, living outside, wandering into traffic, or living in close proximity to traffic. So it's not safe. It's not safe for the people living in the camps. It's not humane for them. And of course, it has negative community impacts. So it's a problem for everyone.
Well, and to the extent it keeps the city from complying with the Americans with Disabilities Act settlement that they entered into, that's, of course, an issue too.
Absolutely. So, yeah, like there are portions of our population that are more deeply affected by the camps. The disabled population is one of them. You know, their mobility is hindered by these camps. You also have children. The elderly. So it's your common taxpayer who's completely mobile, I don't think should have to navigate around these camps. But the people that have degraded mobility are really struggling.
And so what caused you to decide to run for city council?
City council, I think I was looking at the field. I'm working in this realm already, but I was looking at the field take shape in District 3, which is, I think, our most liberal district in the city. And I just wasn't comfortable with the field. No one was representing my perspective. You had socialists, you had progressives. You also had progressives marketing themselves as moderates, which I thought was inauthentic. And ultimately, I just didn't see a way that we were going to put forward a moderate representative. So I decided to jump in and be that moderate representative.
Are you a registered Democrat?
I'm an independent.
You're non-affiliated voter?
No, I was a Democrat
Registered independent.
Yeah, registered independent. I was a Democrat for several years, but I'm not really comfortable with some of the elements of that party.
What caused you to switch?
I was not comfortable here in Portland, especially with the way the conversation had shifted around our public safety issues, sort of the identity-based politics that have come to dominate the Democratic Party. I also felt like the Democratic Party wasn't really looking out for the working class in the way they said they were. I thought there was, you know, they were catering to kind of that professional managerial class at top 10% of the population, but kind of marketing themselves as being a working class party, which I thought was inauthentic. So there were a couple of problems, and you know, I'm not a Republican. I adhere to a lot of classic liberal values. That's why I was initially attracted to the Democratic Party. I think they were stronger on that 10, 15 years ago, but they've kind of gotten away from that. The Democratic Party has become hostile towards free speech, for example, which is a problem for me. They've become more invested in foreign intervention, which is concerning also.
What way do you think?
I think, you know, there's not a, yeah, like the Democratic Party is a little more hawkish, you know, a little bit more willing, like even 10, 20 years ago, and obviously date back to like the Vietnam era, the Democrats were the break on foreign intervention. The Democrats didn't want to go to Vietnam. They were more skeptical of intervention like the second Iraq invasion. And that's not really the case. They're not really the break anymore. They're very gung-ho, like right now with our involvement in Ukraine, for example. They're very hawkish on China in some respects. And that's not really what I'm looking for. So for those reasons and other reasons, like especially on the domestic side, the Democratic Party has been moving in a concerning direction for me.
And you don't identify with the Republican Party. Why?
I just wouldn't describe myself necessarily as conservative, you know, austerity, financial policies, or, you know, I think I also was growing up during that George W. Bush era. I was in high school when Bush was in office and, you know, he had a bad administration. He was bad on maybe civil rights. He was bad on foreign policy. They were kind of hostile towards things like gay marriage. So I came up with kind of negative, very negative feelings towards the Republican Party. And, you know, then we transition into the Trump era and Trump doesn't speak for me either. So I've never identified closely with what they're doing or what they're selling. But unfortunately, I now feel alienated from the Democratic Party, too.
Yeah. Did you ever identify yourself as a progressive?
I think so. Yeah. I think there was a time, especially, you know. Yeah, I was really worried about income inequality, that sort of thing. worried about civil liberties. I worked in law school for criminal defense organizations. So,
which one?
I worked for Youth Rights and Justice. I worked before law school. I worked at a group home for delinquent teenage boys. I also worked at the Oregon Federal Defenders here. So yeah, that's the thing. Like I'm all for like a robust Fourth Amendment interpretations. I believe in guilty until proven innocent. I think mass incarceration
innocent
is
until proven guilty. Yeah.
Yeah. So the innocent until proven guilty. Mass incarceration is a problem. But so yeah, there was a time. I think there are progressive values that appeal to me. But Portland, what we're seeing is a radicalization of progressive values. That's not your everyday common progressivism.
Mm-hmm.
That's not like your Civil Rights Act progressivism. That is what's happening here is bizarre to me. And
oh, it is bizarre.
There's nowhere like it. Exactly. It's forget about the global standard. Even amongst the American standard, this is bizarre.
Yes. Yeah. I mean, San Francisco and Seattle seem to like business, at least more than we do.
Right.
Although it's not hard to like business more than we do, but they managed to do it.
Right. And I haven't spent a ton of time there, but the hostility here towards business, it doesn't make sense to me. The hostility towards home ownership doesn't make sense to me. So, and even just the language we insist on using here. Right.
We were just talking off air about referring to, you know, drug addicts, really, and people suffering from severe mental illness who are on the streets, roaming the streets right outside of here as we walked in here today, as houseless neighbors, as we hear a lot in Portland, as if this is a housing issue.
So that's something I take a lot of issue with. It's concerning to me that people won't speak clearly about what's happening on the streets of Portland. I don't think we're going to solve the problem if we can't even verbally identify the problem. I don't see what's happening on the streets of Portland primarily as an economic or housing issue. I see it as a drug abuse issue and a mental health addiction issue. And that doesn't mean that we don't need to intervene as a society. Those are people that are suffering and need assistance. And I do think we owe them that assistance. But we need to be honest about the type of assistance we're offering and what's going to solve the problem. Yeah, like affordable housing is being used as this magic bullet term for our homeless crisis. I do not believe that the barrier for housing for most of the people on the street of Portland is economic. So affordable housing is not going to solve the problem for a lot of the people on the streets.
Yeah. What would you, if you were on city council, I mean, a lot of this is obviously county stuff, but what can you do since Multnomah County is in charge of addiction and mental health, but what could you do on city council to address things like this addiction and mental health crisis we see playing out on the streets?
Well, I think we need to prioritize funding for services shelters that put people in contact with services. Like we've had success with the task sites like the Clinton Triangle. The problem right now is we need to scale it up. That place houses about 300 people or so. Obviously, we need more.
Is that at capacity?
At capacity, yeah, ballpark 300. We need more places like that that put people in contact with services and rehabilitates them in a way that puts them on a path towards permanent housing.
Is that working? Like, do we have any data of people coming out of Clinton Triangle and getting permanent housing?
I believe there are people. I don't know what the percentages look like. At minimum, though, they are no longer
not on the street.
Yeah, so it's an improvement either way.
Which is obviously very important.
Right. I think we need to have a shelter bed available for anyone that wants one. And I do think we need to enforce an unsheltered camping ban for people that refuse the shelter beds.
What do you say to people like Keith Wilson, who's running for mayor, who says things like we can't arrest our way out of homelessness, things like that?
Well, I think technically he's probably correct. I don't think we have, the practical capacity to arrest our way out of homelessness, nor do I think from a moral standpoint we should be using the criminal justice system to solve the homeless crisis. I don't think that's our best bet. But I do think when shelter beds are available and people refuse shelter beds, we do need to remove them from the right of way. Yeah, it's not acceptable. It's not how society functions. It's just not something we should be expected to tolerate. So we do need to, I think we need to be a little bit more heavy-handed in enforcing a non-camping ban.
How do we intervene? What do we do? How do we get them off the street and intervene in a way that's practically successful?
Well, it's tough. A lot of people are resistant to that intervention.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's right.
Yeah. So I think when they are, we do need to, you know, enforce maybe a criminal penalty. Jail may be a solution in those circumstances to compel them into treatment. But yeah, the individual needs to take some responsibility and recognize that they just can't camp on in public right away. So we need to maybe make a more difficult choice for them, you know, shelter or something in the criminal justice system.
Yeah. Well, yeah, when your brain is hijacked by drugs and mental illness, it's difficult to.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You're obviously having trouble managing your life. What do you know about the Clinton Triangle? Like, does it have to be, you're saying we have to scale it up. Does it have to be this expensive? I mean, you know, Willamette Week said in March 27th, 2024, actually, it said that it's Urban Alchemy is going to make $5 million in 1 year operating Clinton Triangle.
Mm-hmm.
Is that just the cost that we're supposed to take on here?
I have concerns about the
amount. That seems insane.
It seems high. I think right now, if you just look at the nonprofits that are providing services for our homeless people without really even doing anything remotely close to solving.
I agree.
Right. I think the price tag on just the status quo, the nonprofit.
Oh, yeah. No, that's probably billions with a B.
Right. So if we have to spend a few million for Urban Alchemy to manage these sites in a way that undermines that homeless industrial complex or puts people on a path towards permanent housing, I'll sign off on that. I agree with you. I'm concerned with the amount of resources that we have to dedicate towards the homelessness crisis.
Are we going to have to? What's interesting is we know what Urban Alchemy is doing. And as far as I know, they're a nonprofit and we know the money attached to it. But what's interesting to me is, I mean, maybe it's because there's so gosh darn many and Urban Alchemy is new and this Clinton Triangle project is new, but all these nonprofits that you're talking about, this homeless industrial complex nonprofit enterprises going on and funded by really Multnomah County and City of Portland, they're they're publicly funded entities. Like we're all paying for this, but because they're not public entities, they're not subject to Freedom of Information Act requests. Nobody has to disclose what they're getting paid, what their results are. They're not compelled to do so by the city or the county. If you're on city council, what, if anything, can you do about that?
I think that's a great question. I think, you know, provide publicly funded, publicly transparent alternatives that just undercut and funnel resources away from those nonprofits. Yeah, more formal things like the Clinton Triangle or SRV sites that...
Safe Rest Village sites.
Yeah, Safe Rest Village. The nonprofit format is, for the reasons you outlined, concerning. It's also when people have a financial incentive in the homeless crisis, it seems counterproductive to their own interests that they would, you know, solve the homeless crisis. So, yeah, I think we need to chip away at our reliance on that structure.
I don't even know that we're relying on it. I mean, I'm curious as to what we're funding it. I'm curious as to what we're relying on it to do. Besides hand out some of the foil and the pipes that we just walked past on our way in here.
Mm-hmm. Right. So, yeah, I think, I'm skeptical of that structure. I'm skeptical of, I think a lot of people get into it for the right reasons, but then it becomes a lucrative kind of setup. And maybe they stay in it for the wrong reasons.
Well, and I don't know that it's about their intent, but what's, I guess, concerning to me as a citizen and as somebody who had and has a homeless family member. It's just like, well, what exactly are you doing with the money that we're giving you, and how are you solving it, and how many people are you helping, and where is all that data?
Exactly. Yeah. No, and I
that, like justify that, your existence right. or be cut.
Right. And then I can't answer that, and you can't answer
no,
that.
No, none of us can. None of us know.
Right. So that says something, doesn't it?
Would you go as far as doing something like withholding money from the Joint Office of Homeless Services that yeah. we write a check to the county for?
Yes. I think the city needs to assert themselves in that relationship. You know, Commissioner Gonzalez is on the steering oversight board now.
Yeah.
And we've been critical of that relationship and the way they use city money. Dating back to that tent and tarp distribution right. argument. Absolutely willing to be critical of that, of the money going forward and potentially slash funds if that
Or eliminate. I mean, why not just take all of it? Why give them a dime? Why would you give the county a single dime? I don't understand why anybody would do that. I actually don't.
The nuances of that relationship. I'm sure there are areas where they are better equipped and better set up right now.
No.
You don't think so?
No. What are they doing? No. The county? What exactly is the county doing that's effective in regard to street homelessness, drug addiction, or mental health?
So you would rather take that money and set up services internally?
Yeah. I mean, you just talked about scaling up Clinton Triangle. Why couldn't you do a bunch of those?
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, certainly open to it.
Why not?
Yeah.
I mean, the city did that one. There's no reason.
Well, we are working on a second one. I think it was supposed to be open in July. They're a little bit behind schedule.
Where's the second one?
It's up north somewhere, and it should have a component for RV parking.
Okay.
Yeah, get some RVs off the street.
Yeah.
I would like to see more funds spent on our own programs.
All of it. I mean, it's just we know. We definitely know what's not working.
We do. Yeah, and I'm with you in my skepticism of the county. I would want to do a more careful audit of where every dollar's going before I commit like wholesale to.
I think people have tried. There is an auditor, and yet, I mean, even the auditor says more transparency. We don't know. I mean, I don't know. I mean, in order to correctly audit them, you need them to be forced mm-hmm. to give you information that, I mean, according to Sharon Myron, they don't even have it because they don't collect it. So where to start there? I mean, it boggles my mind that they would get one dime from the city. It kind of makes me crazy. What is your priority as a city councilor, homelessness, and if not, what is your priority? Like, what's your number one policy issue?
Number one,
if you're elected,
homelessness and public safety. And I think those things are more related than people let on.
Talk about that.
Well, like we talked about earlier, the homeless camps are not safe for the people living in them or the right. people living near them. And a big part of that, a lot of our gun violence comes from those camps, other kinds of violence, human trafficking, prostitution. There have been dog attacks related to those homeless camps lately.
That poor woman, that mother who's
right. There was one
ended up in the. I mean, it looks like she might. I don't know what's going on with her, but it looked like she was going to die.
I don't know how that resolved itself, but she lost an arm.
Yes,
lost an eye, lost an ear. And that's a more horrific example. But there was a dog attack near my house, right on Hawthorne in Southeast. So it's not like an isolated incident necessarily, usually pit bulls, that sort of thing. Fires, drug overdoses, all related to these homeless camps, which burden the first response system, which is already spread thin. So yeah, the homeless crisis and our public safety problems are very much related.
What do you do in regard to public safety to assist with this drug addiction, mental illness crisis we see playing out on our streets?
That's where technically the mental health facet is the county's responsibility. So, we already...
Is there anything the city can do?
I think we need to restructure.
I don't even know.
Yeah, we restructure that relationship. We already, like, we are providing services, first response services, where we respond to overdoses in a medical sense and then offer to get these people into withdrawal rehabilitation. And, you know, a lot of those people decline that service. So.
I know.
Yeah, like I took a ride along with CHAT recently. Are you familiar with CHAT? It's Fire Department's low acuity medical response team.
What does it stand for?
Community health something team, something okay. like that.
Mm-hmm.
And they're great. But yeah, I went on a ride along with them. Every single response was
community health assess and treat.
Okay.
Yeah. Sorry, go ahead.
Yeah, every response was overdose related, you know.
Every single one?
Every single one. That for the day I was there. Every single
one. The whole day?
Every single one.
And then what happens when CHAT, how does CHAT get alerted to an overdose? Do you know?
Somebody calls 911, says, you know, somebody's passed out on a park bench in this park or that park. CHAT responds, communicates with the person. If the person's unconscious, they'll probably administer Narcan. And, you know, when the person's coherent, they usually offer to put them into a rehabilitation service. And I saw that person decline the rehab every single time. And obviously, small sample size for the day I was there.
Sure.
But speaking with the people I rode along with, that is the common response. So, yeah, we're providing services that are not being accepted. That's, you know, that comes down to personal responsibility of the individual, and at a certain point, we'll probably need to compel drug treatment or, you know, put people in jail to compel drug treatment.
Yeah, well, and I mean, it's helpful that Measure 110, the decriminalization of drugs, was reformed mm-hmm. to recriminalize hard drugs so that we can do things like that.
Mm-hmm.
And if we have enough police officers, maybe we can make a dent in it, but as far as I know, we certainly do not. Currently.
And that's one of my top priorities.
How do you do that? How do you increase the amount of police?
We need to increase funding for the police, and we need to streamline the training process, you know, and we need to...
Right. Your first point was increased funding. What mm-hmm. do you say to people who say, well, the police have been refunded, and not only have they been refunded after the defunding, we've already poured more money into them, and so they don't need any more?
I would say that you are objectively wrong. I would say that our numbers are far below what is commonly accepted as your baseline. A good example is Milwaukee, 50,000 less people, but double the police force. I think we're at 1.2 police officers per 1,000 residents, I think is the number. And we've been higher. We should probably be closer to 2.0. I've heard people say 3.0 would be better. So, and regardless of the numbers and the statistics, we know based on just the eyeball test of the streets, we know it's not working. We know we don't have enough cops. We have a national emergency response time that defies a national standard. It's supposed to be 4 minutes or so. We're at 19 minutes. A lot of that is just a staffing shortfall. So we know we don't have enough police. We've gutted several divisions within the police force, and we've seen crime related to those divisions spike. So. Yeah, I would argue to someone saying the police is properly funded to just come downtown for 10 minutes and take a look around and yeah. make your own determination.
And then your second point was talking about streamlining training. And of course, after 2020 and that the racial reckoning of 2020, the focus has really been pretty closely on police around the country, certainly within Portland. There's been focus on police a long time. I mean, they're under a federal consent decree. It's many, many layers of police accountability already in place. How would you streamline training?
Well, one of the options available is opening our internal training facility.
DPSST in
Salem? Well, we have that in Salem, which is great, but we could open one here in Portland probably. You know, obviously, it wouldn't be the easiest thing in the world, but Yeah, if you talk to cops.
That's a good idea.
Yeah, get them here.
Because it's so hard to get people through DPSST in right. Salem.
So, we could use a racetrack up in North Portland. But another point I wanted to make as far as recruiting more cops, we do need to change the culture here in Portland. It's not hospitable to police officers. It is not a welcoming environment, and that suppresses recruitment efforts. When you got ACAB spray painted on every corner.
That's right.
So
how do we change the culture?
Starts from the top. You gotta have people in leadership positions in city council that are willing to openly advocate for police and support police.
I agree. I just find it absolutely outrageous. The only people since probably Mingus Maps used to seem to be on the side of the police, particularly with the body camera issue. And then after that issue, that Police Accountability Commission, anybody wants to know more about that, listen to the episode that Aaron Schmaltz did about that commission and his trip to Portugal. Mm. And it's what was voted in 2020 that the police union was trying to change via ballot measure and those ballot measures were not successful in court. And I think they're working on new ones, but city council, one thing I do know is a bunch of us went to city council to testify about that Police Accountability Commission measure and asked city council to refer it back to the voters because we didn't think voters understood what we were voting for. I mean, police accountability sounds really great, especially in 2020, but that fine print of that ballot measure was things like interfere in bargaining and discipline police officers and investigate office, be part of investigation of officer involved shootings.
So I took a close look at that.
Tell us about that.
Yeah, I was still with Mayor Wheeler at the time, and I was tasked with digesting that report, that initial recommendation from the police, I'll call them the PAC, but that 96-page report.
So this is after the ballot measure passed,
though. Yeah, so this is the...
Because the commission convened after the ballot measure passed in 2000.
Yeah, so they convened, they spent months. I appreciate them. They are civil servants there. They volunteered their time. I appreciate it. They care about Portland. They put together.
Yes, I think that's right.
Absolutely. And they're coming at it from great places. Like Portland.
I think that's right.
Yeah, we need police accountability. And a cop will tell you that too. And I'll tell you that.
I mean, I think they're, to put a finer point on it, I went to some of those meetings. I think they're coming. I think the commissioners were coming from a good place in regard to a focus on police accountability and probably some trauma in their own lives or lives of relatives in regard to the police. Cause my understanding is they were chosen because they felt over policed in some way, or they had negative potentially interactions with police.
I think that applies to most of them. Yeah.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And I think that may have been a criteria even, but yes, applies to most of them. And I understand that. But what I was also hearing from those commissioners at those meetings, the majority of those commissioners, is that they were, and they were pretty careful to not, most of them, most of the time, careful to not be completely explicit about it, but they were not interested in having more police, making police's job easier in any way. Forget the accountability piece, just making policing easier, getting more police, keeping the amount of police that we have. The feelings towards police generally coming out of that the Police Accountability Commission were in general not positive.
No.
In my opinion.
Nor should they have been.
In my opinion.
No. And here's the thing. I went and rewatched some of the meetings with the commission meetings, internal meetings, when they were crafting the recommendation. I watched Joanne Hardesty go to those meetings and say to the commission, you guys are...
Well, wasn't that her baby? Wasn't that ballot measure Joanne Hardesty's baby? Joanne Hardesty is who Renee Gonzalez defeated to get on city council.
Right.
And she led... Joanne Hardesty, in my opinion, led the charge to defund the police.
Correct. So with that background in mind,
yeah,
she came, this, she's openly hostile towards police. This was her baby. She came into those meetings and said, guys, you are overstepping your purview here. You are going beyond what you are allowed to do. You are supposed to set up a police accountability commission. You're going to mess this up. If you keep doing what you're doing, their finished product, defied her advice and was overexpansive exactly in the way that you're talking about. It wanted oversight of bargaining. It wanted to set up something like an advocacy ability within the community to advocate that they report police misconduct. They wanted to outsource discipline for police officers. They wanted to remove that power from the chief of police.
Well, the state legislature, the Oregon state legislature changed the law in the statutes so that the Police Accountability Commission can interfere with bargaining in unions.
Okay. Yeah. I wasn't familiar with that, but
yes.
Yeah. So yeah, I agree with police. Here's my takeaway from that is they set up this board to hold police accountable, but in doing so, they tried to make themselves unaccountable to anyone. I thought that was ironic and kind of defeated the purpose of the commission.
Hmm. Say more about that.
Well, they just in their proposal, they weren't really accountable to anyone. They didn't really want to interface with anyone. They wanted to use outside counsel. They didn't want to use the city's general counsel because they thought they had a conflict of interest because they were also representing the police. So they really took efforts to set up this isolated and unaccountable commission that would then hold the police accountable. Yeah, I thought that was deeply ironic.
So, I mean, what concerned me by the time the commission's recommendations went to city council and city council was considering it, and of course there were some amendments were made, but substantively, my understanding is that thing is relatively intact. And a bunch of us went to City Hall to testify and ask City Council to send that ballot measure back to the voters. Mm-hmm. Because by then, it had been at least a year or two since the ballot measure passed, and the city was in major crisis. Mm-hmm. And our policing was in major crisis. And we were last, if not next to the last in the country, maybe we were hovering between 48 and 50 for police per capita. Homicides had been skyrocketing. Spiked. 2021, 2022, 2023. I mean, it was just, absolutely out of control. They're still too high. I mean, they're still, everybody says they're down. They're still too high. Look at pre-2020 levels.
Yeah. Yeah. I think that's got to be our standard.
I mean, this is Portland.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And we were one of the safest countries in America. So it's shocking to see that we are no longer one of the safest countries in America. We're not New Orleans. We're not, you know, South Chicago or anything.
The level though of violence that's still going on is unacceptable.
Yeah, it's unacceptable.
Kind of small. Yeah. People say, well, we're a big city now. No, we're not.
Yeah.
We are not Chicago or LA or Seattle and even, there were all those articles, 2021, 2022, comparing us to larger cities, mm-hmm. and saying that our violence was outsized. Even compared to them.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. No, there's too much gun violence.
This was the most dangerous place to be a black man.
Yeah.
Due to gun violence. I mean, Portland, the whitest city in America, really. I mean, it was so bad. And I just remember the city council wouldn't do it. They wouldn't send it back. Yeah. They wouldn't send it back. And I know... My understanding is that they had votes to send it back from Commissioner Gonzalez and Commissioner Ryan, and MAPS wouldn't do it. And nobody else would do it. And I've heard some good things coming from the majority of city council about police. But, the idea that police morale is just going to move on as normal with that commission in effect is, that's not going to happen. I mean, it's no one will want these jobs. No one.
No, it's
I mean, you know, those people get their own security detail, the police accountability.
Yeah, I saw that. Oh, and one thing.
Their own security that we pay for.
One thing the council did take issue with. So we've talked about the fine print that I think most people missed on that commission.
Everybody missed.
What people did recognize, and which was, in my view, ridiculous, is that they wanted to exclude police officers from serving on the accountability commission, which to me did not make much sense.
Well, and anyone who has a family member in law enforcement was not allowed to participate. And my understanding is through amendments from city council, namely Commissioner Ryan and Commissioner Gonzalez, proposing those amendments, my understanding is that has been changed.
Yes, I believe it has. So, there's a problem. And like you said, suppresses recruitment efforts and, suppresses morale. And it all relates to, like, the spike in gun violence. To solve those issues, we need police. But, if we're openly hostile towards our police officers, it's unlikely that we're going to recruit or fund the police.
I mean, how can we not have a city council and a mayor? We need a city council, like you said, top down, a city council and a mayor that explicitly supports police.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, explicitly.
And really listens to what they need. Aaron Schmaltz explained this when he came on by himself last time. We have many layers of police accountability. Mm-hmm. We already have those. Those are in place. We have a ton. That's a quote from him. And this idea that we're missing police accountability measures and we just don't have it in the city of Portland, that's not true.
It's a post-2020 narrative.
Yes. Mm-hmm. Yeah, that we need more and more and more and more. And at some point, it becomes not about accountability. If you really look at what's behind it, it becomes about squashing them.
Oh, yeah.
Squashing the police.
Yeah, I don't doubt the motives of some of them.
And deluding the police.
Sure. Yeah.
In my opinion.
Now, there are people motivated by that. Yeah. And it's not to say we don't need police accountability, but I do think
we have it. I don't think we should eliminate it. I mean, no. I think we absolutely need it. If they don't have credibility, they can't do their jobs.
Right. Yeah.
Then it's over. Then we've got New Mexico problems. Then we're on the other side of the spectrum, and we've got a useless police force that's filled with criminals.
Right. And the police recognize that.
Of course they do.
They know that. Yeah.
The
police here do. They
know. They don't want to be delegitimized. I don't think want to be delegitimized.
Bob Day wants a tight crew. Yeah.
He wants the chief.
He wants them all to be exemplary professionals. Yeah. They all do. You know, so there is incentive within the police force to discipline themselves and to be tight and be accountable to the community.
I have this feeling that not everybody on city council is going to feel the way you do.
No.
About police. And so how do you change this culture that you were talking about through a top down?
Well, this election is important.
Yes.
It's very important.
Well, it certainly is.
Yeah. We need a moderate majority on council.
I agree. But do you think you're going to get that?
It's going to be close. It's going to be very close.
I agree.
I think it'll come down to maybe within one person. I feel confident right now about Gonzalez's chance to win the mayor race. Obviously, nothing's guaranteed. That will be a huge win for the moderate cause, for the first responder cause.
I agree,
Hopefully he can install a city manager that is not challenged by a progressive council. So that's a huge start. But then, we need good people on council, and we need the majority of council. We need, Terrence Hayes and Eli Arnold, Bob Simrell. We need those kind of people on council. So it's going to be very tight.
Yeah, I think so too. So how are you going to, let's say it's not a majority moderate council, how are you going to reach across the aisle, if you will, and work with, we're not going to have conservatives. So how are you going to, we're going to have left of center and far left people, I would imagine. So how will you work with the more far left counselors to do things like assist with the legitimization and the support of public safety?
My hope is that being in office will have a moderating influence on those people, I think it depends who we're talking about. There are some candidates in this race that I don't believe will be reachable or will be amenable to any sort of pro-public safety or pro-police initiatives at all. My hope is that most of the progressives who are skeptical of our police force will be moderated by the realities of representing constituents. And I've been at City Hall. A lot of that time has been external facing, and the overwhelming sentiment throughout the population of Portlanders is that we need police and we need public safety improvements. So I'm hoping that.
Yeah, the polling says most Portlanders want public safety. They want police.
Absolutely, especially in places like East Portland.
Yeah, the defunding was not popular, particularly, like you said, in the communities that are most plagued by violence.
And that's a bizarre little paradox of the whole situation. Yeah, you had well-to-do white people in Kearns and in Hawthorne and Sunnyside saying we don't need cops because they're, you know, from their perspective, you didn't need cops. They kind of hijacked this Black Lives Matter narrative, and they imposed this defund the police movement on communities that have suffered because of it. Ironically, many of those communities are minority communities. When I've been sitting at City Hall the last couple of years, what I see overwhelmingly is a desire for enhanced public safety. There's no equivocation there. You know, you have a very vocal minority that is still anti-police, but your average Portlander absolutely wants an enhanced police presence.
Yeah, that's my understanding from the polling. How are you going to address these things? I understand we talked about culture, and funding. I like the idea of another training facility. My understanding is once you're on city council, will then be a legislative body, right? Mm-hmm. So you're not in charge of a bureau anymore.
Not at all.
And so you're making laws, I guess.
Mm-hmm.
What are the other kinds of policies that you're considering should you be elected to city council?
In general or with respect to police funding?
Well, what are your, in regard to your priorities, I guess, would be?
Priorities, expand shelter for homelessness, and also, I want to impose a culture that generally is less lenient, less permissive of lawbreaking. I don't want to market myself as this law and order guy. Like I mentioned, I'm coming from a criminal defense background, a lot of respect for people on the other side of the criminal justice system and the criminal justice system. But the over permissiveness and the over leniency in Portland has really degraded our quality of life in a way that I would like to counteract from council. A good example of that. We're rolling out like a little tougher stance on graffiti right now, from the Gonzales administration. That's forthcoming. That's the sort of thing I'd like to take a closer look at, things like that, initiatives like that in the future.
So, livability kind of initiatives.
Absolutely.
Yeah. And accountability initiatives. Right. How do you enforce things like graffiti and enforce things like, we call it a camping ban, but really it's a ban of, in my opinion, open air drug markets and open air insane asylums. How do you enforce things like that without more police?
Be exceedingly difficult, probably. To comprehensively enforce that, it would be impossible without more police.
Yeah, I mean, when drugs were recriminalized and Measure 110, which decriminalized hard drugs, was reformed, I just remember thinking, I mean, they all, you saw this walking in. I mean, there was a cop car. There will be. They'll still be outside when we walk out. And the lights will be on and they'll be shoving people into it. Mm-hmm. And there'll be more as you walk back to your job at City Hall. You'll see more. And you'll see more people being shoved into cop cars and more ambulances and more people being Narcan and more people being revived. And it's like, we're already stretched so thin. I don't know how. I mean, we still don't even have a deflection center for Multnomah County. According to Eli Arnold, they call, who's a on PBB Central Bike Squad, who's running for city council for District 4. He said, well, they call peer support specialists when they see somebody doing drugs or doing something that would qualify under the new recriminalization of drugs. And the peer support specialists show up. They say, you want to talk to us or you want to go to jail? They say, we'll talk to you. And when Eli turns around and leaves, that's the end of it. Mm-hmm. So as long as the answer is yes, then that's the end of that police encounter.
Yeah. So we need a rigid structure in there. Rigid structure.
Isn't that on the county?
We need to open the deflection center and we need to transport people to the deflection center and we need them to process people. Yeah. At risk of being incarcerated.
How are you going to work with the county in regard to things like this? Because in my opinion, now I know we might get a majority of the county to get interested in policing and to get interested in drug rehabilitation and drug treatment and to get actually interested in solving addiction as mm-hmm. opposed to just harm reduction and disease reduction. But, and disease not being drug addiction, disease being, I think, HIV, I guess Hep C. How do we get the county on board? Because, you know, to the extent you're going to want to work with them or at least lead on these issues, I know we might get a majority of people who are interested in those things, like if Vadim Mazursky and Sam Adams are elected. Mm-hmm. But if they're not, even if they are, and they can't, if they can't override the chair, Jessica Vega Peterson, then we're where we are. We're just in status quo. And how do you, communicate with them?
I have seen, granted, there's a power imbalance sometimes, but I have seen a firmer hand has been somewhat effective from the Gonzales administration. Dealing with them more firmly, more assertively has been effective. You know, they're not buying new tents and tarps right now because of our pressure.
What worked? What was it that worked? And what would you do?
I think you need to just really assert the city's interest more.
It a press conference? Was it?
Sure. Oh, yeah. I mean, the press can be leveraged. Absolutely. It's just not, you gotta have a little backbone. I mean, that's basically what it comes down to. You need to.
Is it public criticism?
Yeah.
It's of the county on a specific policy issue. And then you just don't, I mean, I'm trying to remember what he did. I mean, I guess you would know, you just don't stop talking about it, I guess.
And that's one example. So the ambulance staffing model was another. You know, we finally got this capitulation from JVR.
JVP, the chair of Multnomah County, yeah.
Exactly.
Because we were having trouble getting ambulances to respond. We had this severe shortage.
Severe shortage. She was holding on to this two paramedic staffing model. We wanted a one-to-one model. We kept the pressure on for months. And there's finally capitulation. You're seeing now we have the steering oversight committee in place and we have the option of withdrawing from the IGA. So there are
the IGA is the intergovernmental agreement.
Right. There's that
between the city and the county.
There's that 90 day little probationary thing put in place last June. That 90 day mark.
That was a condition of the city's money mm-hmm. for the joint office. Is that right?
Yeah. So,
Of homeless services between the city and county. Yeah.
Exactly. And that's another point. So you can be a little firmer. You can put in conditional relationships, conditional IGAs, things that are answerable to certain deliverables, certain hard numbers. So I think that's the thing. We just need to be more assertive on the city side and set expectations and then set consequences for when those expectations aren't met. And that's a little bit vague, but I think that's what we need to do.
Do you have any idea how they're doing on those conditions, those IGA conditions?
How
the county's doing?
I mean, that's coming up. That's going to be a big public conversation in a few weeks here. And we are, Commissioner Gonzales is on that oversight committee. He's a swing vote. And if they are not upholding their end of the bargain, we are going to back out. The city is going to back out. So more on that in a month or so.
So I don't know about silly, but just a personal interest question. Mm-hmm. Your bio for your journalism website, you said it's the National Interest, right? Is what it's called.
That's where I'm at now.
It says that you play guitar. Are you in a band?
I wish. Yeah, I need to get that going.
Really? Are you going to get one going?
I would love to.
How often do you play?
Every day.
Really?
Yeah, I practice religiously.
You should get one going.
Yeah,
I heard everybody goes on Craigslist. Honestly, that it's only alive for music. Well, prostitution, of course, but music apparently is where. I mean, I know it sounds ridiculous, and I'm not a musician. I don't know anything about it. But the musicians I know say that's how they get their gear and find bandmates. And I don't know, but
yeah,
you got to go. Yeah, you should. You should go somewhere and figure it out.
I've been busy lately.
Well, sure.
There's always an excuse.
You're ready for
right.
You're writing for this National Interest. You're working for a commissioner who also that same commissioner has a mayoral race going. And mm-hmm. So is like probably going on overdrive as a commissioner. And yes, I can't imagine what your life is like.
It's a mess. Yeah. It's a mess right now. It's a mess.
Probably not a lot of, although if you're playing guitar every day, anyway, to clear your head, you might as well do it in a band. I don't know.
I should. Yeah. I spent a lot of time. Just bedroom guitarist, recording stuff, writing stuff too.
Oh, really?
Yeah. But my hours are down, my weekly hour, like I'm not playing in the way that I would have in the past, but there have been times in my life where I, you know, went through 3-4-5 hour a day practice sessions.
Wow.
Yeah. I was pretty serious for a while. And it was all self-taught, which I wouldn't recommend. I'm sure that wasn't the most efficient way to do it, but I am.
Wow.
Yeah.
Eli Arnold said he is self-taught too.
Oh, is he?
Yeah. He said he taught himself. If I remember correctly, when he was on Northwest Fresh on Andy's show, I think that we talked to him. It's all such a blur. Friday night, I want to say, but he said he taught himself when he was in Afghanistan.
Yeah,
when he was stationed there.
Good time to do it.
Yeah. I mean, he was like, my time was super busy and structured, and then there was this weird amount of time that wasn't. And
do you know what type of music he's playing?
I know what he likes. He said he likes prog rock.
Okay. Yeah.
And he said he likes, he likes the Decemberists. I think he said his wife likes, we asked about Death Cab for Cutie because Will Lathrop, who's running for attorney general, also plays guitar and, was in a punk band. And he said that he told Andy, this was also on Northwest Fresh. This was last week. He told Andy, I don't know when it'll air, but he said he would be prosecuting cases when he worked as a deputy district attorney, and then on his lunch break he'd go to the bus stop and play guitar.
That's awesome.
Clear set. It was awesome.
That's cool.
It was so awesome. And he said he was in a punk band and now he listens to prog rock and he liked Death Cab for Cutie, so we asked Eli about it and he said no, but maybe he said he didn't like that, but his wife was a big Modest Mouse fan. I don't remember, but those names came up.
Okay.
And I don't know. So this says you like Dokken.
I love Dokken.
Who else do you like?
Oh man. I go pretty deep, but the more recognizable ones from the genre I like would be like Whitesnake, Def Leppard, Bon Jovi.
I love Def Leppard.
Yeah. They're fantastic.
I love Bon Jovi.
They were here. Def Leppard was here last week. We all went to see him.
Oh, was it good?
It's fantastic.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. They sing
they
so
Moda?
Well. They were Moda.
Yeah.
Packed. And, they came on after Journey. They were tighter than Journey.
Tighter?
They were.
They sound.
They're so fantastic.
The last time I saw them, I think it was like 3 years ago in Vegas, and they weren't. I'm trying to remember who opened for them. It wasn't Journey. It wasn't that duo, but it was. I think it was just them. Actually, they did like a mini residency.
They did a residency. Yeah, yeah. I remember that.
And there's a video of one of the concerts, and that was the one I was at.
Okay.
And they sounded, I was there with my late husband, and we loved them, and he loved them, and I bought it for him as a birthday present, and they sounded, I just remember, we would still talk about it years later, they sounded the same.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
I mean, it was record quality. It was like recording.
That's the thing.
Quality.
They're fantastic. Yeah, they're a well-oiled machine at this point.
Holy crap.
They can all sing. So you got like these three-part harmonies, every chorus, the guitar's locked in. You got Vivian Campbell from Dio as one of the guitars. That's another band I love. But yeah, Def Leppard is a fantastic band.
Yeah.
Yeah. I would recommend them for anyone that just appreciates live music. They are worth seeing.
Oh, totally. Mm-hmm. Who else have you seen?
Oh, my father took me to dozens of concerts growing up.
And, oh, really?
Well, I took him rather. He funded, but
sure.
I
you're like, let's go see this. Let's go see this.
I mean, we saw everyone. I saw Judas Priest, Dio, Dokken, Wasp, Tesla,
wow.
Black Sabbath, Ozzy, wow. Iron Maiden, Motorhead, Metallica was my big one.
Oh,
in
wow.
High school.
That's amazing.
Yeah, just down the line.
I wish I'd seen Metallica.
I love Giant too. You ever heard of Giant? Most people haven't heard of them.
No.
Yeah, they're very high quality. Dan Huff does a lot of production for like Nashville country these days, but yeah, he was.
Really?
Yeah.
Oh, interesting.
Super talented. Who else have I seen? I mean, I've forgotten more about 80s rock than I know.
And
about.
Is that the kind of music that you play and write? Is it like 80s style rock? Oh,
yeah, definitely. Yeah. I'm mildly obsessed with 80s rock and 80s popular culture in general, but I hope
really?
That's not disqualifying as a candidate. But
hardly. No, I mean, I want Portland to be a music place again.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. I don't think most people would make it a 80s rock music place, but yeah, the music scene.
I don't know. I maybe not an 80s rock music place, but it doesn't need to be. I mean, this summer, my kids and I were in Austin and. Mm-hmm. We went to some shows mm-hmm. and we went to one, you know, and it was just, my understanding is it's changing and their music scene is not what it was.
Okay.
And they're being displaced by clubs and house music and restaurants that just sort of pump out digital music all the time, kind of a thing. And a lot of it, my understanding is because musicians can't really afford to live there anymore, which is too bad. But the street, and I'll remember which one it was, but the street that we were on, I just remember we came out and my daughter, my teenager.
Was it 6th Avenue?
It was, yes, it was.
Yeah.
E6th. Mm-hmm. That's right. We were at Hotel Vegas. And my daughter came, obviously it was all ages. And my daughter came out and looked around and it just up and down the street, there were all these other shows going on and some had just started and some people were in line. Some people were coming out just like we were. And she said, is there anything else like this in the United States? And I said, I don't know. Not that I know of.
Maybe like
she's
Nashville.
Like, well, what she thought, but I think that's a different genre.
Oh, sure, sure.
What she thought of was new. We've been visited New Orleans
okay.
and seen some jazz in New Orleans. And she said, I know there's jazz in New Orleans and I know there's music places in New Orleans, but like something like this, like rock clubs, like small rock clubs. And she'd never been to one before. And she'd never been to like a small rock club before. They'd never done that. So they like we had the commercial earplugs and all the other stuff. I'm assuming you have commercial earplugs.
I should.
Yes, you certainly. You are going to ruin your hearing, Harrison.
I've gone
through.
You
will ruin it.
You know, that's funny. The Air Force tested my hearing. My hearing's still good.
Are you kidding me?
Yeah, it's still good.
But, you must be really genetically gifted.
Maybe that's
after all those concerts and everything. I mean, so I never wore those. I never wore those. I mean, I grew up going to like small club rock shows my whole adolescence, mm-hmm. all through high school, a lot of college, and then just bigger. Now I'm just old and it's bigger. It's just bigger venues. I mean, sometimes it's smaller, but that's with people that, musicians that I know. It's not because I'm in that scene and I don't know anything about what scene there is here, if any. But I said, I don't think that there is. I don't think there's a rock scene like this anywhere else. I mean, I couldn't think of it. It was really cool to see and it was really busy. Mm-hmm. And people were out and it was if I remember correctly, it might've even been a weeknight. I mean, it was, if not, it was like a Friday or something, but I just remember thinking, you know, I know for a while Seattle was like that. I don't know what it's like now. I'm assuming it still has some kind of scene. I know Portland had one. And I wish we could bring it back. I mean, I don't even care about this Live Nation thing. Like, why not do that? I mean, I, like Eli said, isn't there a difference between their business practices and whether we should bring in a music venue? Like, why not? And bring in some business into the city.
Yeah.
How do you feel about that Live Nation thing?
You know, I'm not tracking on that too closely. My feeling is that, yeah, it's probably not perfect, but you know, maybe there are better venues, better hosts, but like you said, I'm pro music. I would like more music, yeah, more opportunities here. So if that's all we've got to work with, I'm not necessarily opposed, but.
Well, I like a flipping stadium, honestly. I mean, I like the idea of Taylor Swift coming here and bringing in all that tourism for restaurants and hotels. And I mean, no joke.
Yeah,
that's a whole industry. Those stadiums. Industry.
Yeah, I think like
Morgan Wallen and all those people. I mean, I know there's going to be a whole bunch of pushback about these commercial artists, blah blah blah, and indie artists. And look, we need those commercial artists to fund the indie artists. We need that, and we need to bring in that tourism industry to fill these hotels around here. And if we're going to see some kind of vibrant, any kind of scene back here, we've got to start filling hotels and restaurants in downtown.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. We need commercial draws. Yeah, absolutely. We need, you know, the WNBA is coming. That's great. That's the start.
Yeah. That's something.
Things like that. You know, we need something big. Yeah. I'm not hostile to, I don't necessarily enjoy the music, but I'm not hostile like Taylor Swift.
Right.
Yeah. We need something big. Yeah. Yeah, baseball.
Yes. Well, that's still in play is my understanding, pun intended, I guess. But
yeah.
I mean, I heard it's a possibility.
Yeah. I think it's on the table.
Well, as long as it's on the table, yeah, something to look forward to.
Yeah. I'm not 100% optimistic, but yeah, we need something like that. And commercial music would be great. Def Leppard's a start, but yeah, maybe something more contemporary would be better for our economy.
Well, and just like, why can't we have a street like E6? Like, why can't we?
That'd be cool.
There's no reason we can't.
Yeah, no.
I'm sure there's enough music here. I'm sure it could be a draw.
It is all kind of dislocated, all isolated off a venue here.
It is isolated.
Yeah, I know what you're saying. That would be cool, just to have a cool strip.
We could create something, though.
Yeah.
Just like they did. I mean, why not?
Yeah. No, that'd be awesome.
Anything else you want to talk about?
Nothing comes to mind. Is there anything you want to talk about, Portland or background? Or
I mean, I think this was great. It was really helpful. Thank you for running, Harrison. And
of course.
Everybody who wants to donate, where do they go if they want to go to your website?
Castforpdx.com. That's KASS.
Castforpdx.com. All right. Well, this is Harrison Cass. He's running for city council here in Portland for District 3. Thanks so much, Harrison.
Thanks a lot. This is great.